Hello and welcome to the Leadership Learned podcast, brought to you by the Inspirational Group. Each episode, we examine how leadership behaviors, skills, and attributes improve performance from the classroom to the boardroom. We discuss the latest issues, delve into the current thinking, and provide tangible insights as we go beyond the cliches to prove that leaders are made, not born. Today's episode is all about confidence and change, two forces that often feel mutually exclusive, but when dealt with properly can result in a more successful and easier transformation, whatever that may be. Whether you're leading a team through transformation or making a bold career move yourself, we'll be looking at topics relevant to that and answering questions like, how do we build confidence when facing uncertainty? How do leaders show up with courage even when they don't have all the answers? And much more besides. To help us unpack all of this, we have our regulars Nigel Girling and Dr. Rona McKenzie, and I'm delighted that we're also joined by our special guest, Andrew Richards. Andrew is a highly experienced ICF accredited coach who has worked with leaders across industries to help them navigate transitions, step into their strengths, and feel more confident about the future. Andrew has a fascinating story of his own. He had a successful career as a VP and SVP of sales in the life sciences industry before a career shift that required quite a lot of personal resilience, and we'll be getting into that as well. So, Andrew, welcome to the podcast. And I wanted to begin by asking you, what was it that attracted you to becoming a coach?
Well, thanks for such a lovely, warm welcome. I'm not used to being called special, so thank you for that. it seems like a long time ago now, but the initial turning point was that I realized that over the years, people have been coming to me and asking what I thought about stuff. So this is an early turning point. Why are people coming to me asking what I think of stuff, which is nothing to do with coaching, as we'll come to later, but I seem to be a bit of a magnet among my colleagues, friends, and people who didn't even know me that well to bounce ideas from, I guess because I'm a vaguely reassuring sort of a chap. So that was the starting point of realizing that people were very much at home sharing stuff with me. And that was years ago, probably at the start of my career. But as I went through my career doing my various jobs, I came to a crunch point like many people in their 40s do. And I was actually made redundant by company. And that's not an uncommon thing. Many people will be familiar with what that's like. And the first time it happens to you, it's rather horrible. You tend to take it a bit personally. And it's usually a surprise as well. And all those things were true for me. And my wife could see I wasn't handling it particularly well for the first few days. And she suggested I speak to somebody about it. And I had a friend who was a coach, still is a coach to this day, a very successful coach. And we just had a chat. It wasn't really coaching. It was just a conversation. But he was able to ask me some questions during that informal chat while I was feeling pretty low that completely shifted the way I was looking at my own situation. And I banked that conversation, I suppose, and kept it on ice in the background so that when I eventually got another job, and HR came around and said, hey, Andrew, what would you like to do for your leadership development? I thought, well, hang on a minute. What about coaching? And to my surprise, joy, and amazement, my employer said, okay, Andrew, we'll pay for you to do 18 months of coach training. As soon as I went through the doors of the coaching school, it was a revelation.
So what sort of things do you work on with people? And is there a general focus to what you do?
Usually, you know, the pretext is work stuff. In the reality of it, it's never just work stuff. It's always a whole load of other stuff mashed together with work stuff. So it might ostensibly be an executive transition, but there's always relationships in there, identity, confidence, fear, so many different things wrapped together in someone's snapshot in time decision that they want some support in writing the next chapter. So those people vary from right the senior leadership teams of listed companies to founders to mid-level executives in companies, to teachers, to, yeah, anybody who seems to think I'm making sense on LinkedIn and decides to reach out. But I do triage carefully for fit. So for me to do my best work, I need people who actually can speak freely and there's good energy, strong intention, and a willingness to go to the places they need to go to do the work. So
are there common threads that run through your work that relate to confidence, particularly in respect to leadership?
Yes, there are. Much of it, I think, is due to conditioning. So we get that massively wrong, I think, in Western society, at least, by templating what the expectation is among young people as they go into professional leadership roles. And we force people through a funnel with the expectation that they will be some kind of well-rounded, capable leader at the other end of it, who is following a predictable pattern in their career with three-year gaps, measured steps of promotion towards whatever edifice they're pointing themselves to, whether it's CEO, partner, managing director, or whatever. So that tends to be the conditioning. And that messes a lot of people up who aren't that shape. So somewhere along the way, usually at some point between 35 and 60, people realize, some of them, I'm not really that shape, for a whole variety of reasons. And that tends to combine with, you know, existential stuff. And is this it? And can't I be doing more? So that is the theme, usually. And in terms of leadership, realizing that there are very many different ways of showing up as a leader, not just in the corporate sense or the organizational sense, but in the leader of your life as well.
Okay. And so what about people's values and characters, and when they're not in the right alignment for what you think they want to achieve? How do you go about helping them with that?
That's a great question. I mean, people's values are their values. What can trip people up is being unclear about them. So thinking that their values are something, or thinking that they value something, when in fact, if you probe them on it, it isn't of so much value to them after all, especially as it relates to financial matters. So a lot of people, especially execs in companies, will value a lifestyle that they've accumulated over a period of time, right? So they're getting promoted, additional responsibility, more money, share options, whatever it might be. And when they reach their moment of questioning the trajectory, it looks like a really long way down based on what they've already accrued. And they think that's going to go if they change direction and leave those things behind. So sometimes there's an inflated value around measurements of success. I call them measuring sticks. So size of house, size of pension pot, flashiness of title, you know, whatever watch you're wearing on your wrist or whatever, you know, believe it or not, people think about those things and have values around them that actually, when they're probed on it, aren't there.
Yeah, it's interesting at that kind of at that identity level of I identify as the car, the house, the pension pot, the salary.
Yeah.
And so when there's the chance that that's going to go away, I finished my headship and I went from being the principal to a student. I did an MBA. And so and at the time, I just felt like I didn't really know who I was anymore.
Yeah.
And part of it was really freeing because I wasn't anybody. And I heard myself say, I used to be a head teacher, like that had value.
Mm.
And now I'm a student. And, oh, well, isn't that good fun to have a gap year when you're 41?
Yeah.
But actually, deep down, I just thought, I'm not quite sure who I am now.
Yeah.
And spent quite a bit of time doing some work on working out, well, who am I and what do I want? And actually, I'd say that the next probably 4 years was the journey of working out who was I, what were my values, what were my motivators, and what did I really want from my life? And I'm curious, do you ever use psychometrics or any other tools with clients to help them kind of unpack that if they can't see it themselves?
Not as many as some coaches. I've been through many of them, and I've seen the reports of many psychometric outputs. Some are better than others, but again, they tend to spit out you're a blue or a yellow or some kind of four-digit, four-letter acronym at the end of it. And to me, that just gives people another identity they don't actually need. So they've done all that work to let go of being a VP of sales who lives here, has this much money in the bank, insert the measuring stick of your choice. We push them for a psychometric and they grab hold of another identity instead, which is still nothing to do with them, really. When I really go deep with people in the coaching, the same three things always seem to come up about what people are really valuing when it comes down to it. And what I find is somewhere nice to live, someone good to love and be loved by, and something good to do. And the rest of it is kind of gravy, really. And then if you keep that there and also at the same time understand that you are so much more than any role you happen to be holding at any particular time on your journey of life, then so there's so much more available to you as a human to go and explore and choose and set new intentions by. So psychometrics, the only one I suppose I do is not really a psychometric. I quite like StrengthsFinder. Because the way that's written is a nice book that's quite readable. You've got the, I can't remember how many strengths in it, and they're 30-odd strengths. You do a fairly simple assessment and you get your top five supposed strengths that you can't help being good at. And the book actually tells you what the hell you're supposed to do with those. So it gives you a bit of a clue, and then you can choose what you interpret there. So I quite like that.
We use StrengthsFinder, and I like it as well, particularly because it's such a positive way of thinking that whatever problem I might be encountering, I can decide which of my, as I call them, my superpowers to dial up and use to find a solution or find a way forward. What I have found interesting about some psychometrics is the ability to be really curious about my motivators or my values and how that might be driving some of my thinking. And so when I joined IDG, I recognized that being in a sales-oriented job was not what floats the boat for me. It's not about making money for an organization. It's making a difference for people. And it would have been so easy to fall entirely into the wrong job. By just by accident, because I wasn't aware of that. So some of those underlying values are kind of helpful to know. But I am interested on the character piece. It's partly because it's a big area of thinking for me at the moment, but I'm thinking more how our character shapes our ability to lead, whether it's our own lives or lead others. And it seems to be that, like parenting, the thing we don't learn about, but that has the biggest impact in the world. And I'm curious as to whether kind of their character traits come out in coaching, and if that's ever explored.
Definitely. The character always comes out sooner or later, usually at the same time as somebody's ego as well. So we have to do a bit of ego and character spotting and noticing which is which and who's doing the talking. So once people get their heads around the idea that I'm not suggesting they're always talking to themselves, they usually play along and can identify, that's probably my ego showing up, wanting something for me, or, it's my subconscious saboteurs, or maybe in this case, this is truly me and what I think and care about. And that actually takes quite a bit of training, self-training, to think, okay, which bit of me is showing up here and saying this stuff? If we all think about it, as soon as we get up in the morning, before we do anything else, our eyes open and we look at something, usually, hopefully not your phone, but let's say you open the window and you look outside and you see, I don't know, a bird on the lawn. Your character's already seen that bird, right? You've seen it. But that doesn't stop your subconscious bubbling up and saying, oh, look, a bird. Like a nanosecond later. So we've always got a running commentary from the subconscious telling us what we already know.
I'm doing a course at the moment on positive intelligence. And when you talk about saboteurs, it's exactly focused on that. So how does your judge play out, and how loud is your judge? Where is it focused? But I found it fascinating because my two saboteurs, we know every action there's a positive intention. Sometimes I question my kind of achieving highly and restless saboteurs who persuade me to do everything constantly now and have no time for anything.
Another very good and powerful, shortish but very informative assessment. So
What was that? I'm not. What's the saboteur? Is that a type of assessment?
It is. So loosely, this is the work of Shirzad Shamil. Positive Intelligence is his book. He's got a very elegant way of isolating down the different voices of the subconscious. So we've all got a judge judging us in the round, but each of us has got, in this model at least, a kind of footprint or finger, you know, a unique fingerprint. It's probably the better way of saying it, of the top voices of sabotage. So think of it a bit like a choir, right? You might have a really powerful trio or duet of a couple of voices that really give you a hard time. So in adversity, when you're not having the best day, what are the loudest subconscious voices giving you a roasting? So me and Rona were just laughing that we've got the same two. Restless is my top one. So, you know, that's the, oh, look, squirrel. Even my subconscious telling me to move on to something else more interesting. And hyperachiever, whatever I do isn't good enough. So, you know, even if I have the best month ever as a coach, hyperachiever will tell me, no, that was total crap. You know, you're a waste of space. Go back and get a job as a VP of sales.
Mm-hmm.
It's that kind of idea.
And the idea obviously being then once you've identified them, you can learn how to deal with them and recognize when they're talking, is it?
That's it. You can powerfully characterize them. So I help people usually by giving them a name, basing them on a cartoon character or somebody else they know, so that when they feel and notice that saboteur coming, they can actually look it in the eye and sort of metaphorically strap it into the child seat a bit and get on with what they want to do. So it's a great way of coping with negative self-talk, basically.
And on the coaching course that I'm on at the moment, it's about 7 weeks long, and they teach you to do what they call PQ reps, which is basically a form of just stopping your mind from the rush and the saboteur taking over and having a moment to focus. I was on a very intense call earlier today and I could feel my brain flying about. And so I focused just by looking at one person on the screen really intently and looking at the detail. So getting my eyes to really look. And then for a few seconds, I focused only on what I was hearing them say and nothing else. And so by the brain then focusing on one of the senses, it can almost take you out of that sabotage moment and put you back into a clearer headspace.
It's fantastic that, Ronan. Yeah. It, the way it works, I think, is that it overworks the brain if you're really focusing on listening to somebody, or, you know, it doesn't need to be a person. You could be looking at a hair on the back of your hand and studying how many colors there are in it for a moment. It takes a hell of a lot of brain power to do that properly. Mm. And at the same time, it completely dims down all the other chatter you might be hearing because of the work involved in that focus. So, yeah, it's really good and definitely better than breathing in and out of a brown paper bag.
Yeah. And before the podcast, at about 3:15, my brain was flying through the 1,000 things I needed to do. And I had a moment of, that's interesting. So this is my restless playing out enormously. So I did 2 minutes of PQ reps and then went and got a drink and came and sat down so that I could show up as my best self, not as a restless person. And so I think the awareness that brings is really interesting. And then someone said to me on a call earlier, I'm not sure that everyone is aware and are curious. And so how... in your coaching, does it sort of come up over time? Does people's curiosity kind of develop over time? How does that play out?
Everyone's different there. Some people are really ready to do that. And for other people, it's buried far deeper. And it takes a lot more relaxed time, level of comfort to build up before they can actually notice other things going on. So to a large extent, it does also depend on whether they've had an experience of any kind of talking intervention before, whether that's coaching, mentorship, friendship, therapy, any of the above. if someone's been starved across the board of those things, then there's a long way to go before they'll reach the comfort level to notice that stuff. Mm. Whereas if someone's had five coaches, been in therapy, has a big friendship group and is naturally a talker, then the first 10 seconds of the coaching session, they're ready to go into it. It's a really big gradient, I think, of depending on where you find people. You've got to meet them where they are.
And I guess that comes back to the confidence piece Matt mentioned earlier, in terms of not just about having the confidence to take a decision in your life to do differently, but also, so from having the confidence to speak to you and to show up and to be vulnerable and to go to places that we might never have been to before, or that might be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
That's what you provide in that space, holding that space for them to feel comfortable to do that.
Yeah. I think it's really important to say at the outset that it doesn't matter to me what people choose to do as a result of their coaching. I mean, I prefer if they didn't harm other people, obviously, but their choices are theirs. I have zero attachment to any particular outcome for people. So, I don't know, let's say if we're actually doing some relationship coaching and someone thinks they want to get divorced, fine. If that's what you want to do, let's work on that. I'm not going to sit here and have a different idea about what would be best for them. So setting that up at the start is really important. It's none of my business. I'm here to help you accelerate towards what you're trying to do.
Yeah, that's an interesting distinction with the work that we mostly do, where we are deliberately trying to take someone into direction on behalf of their organization or their team or their peer group or whoever it might be. So, but I hear you, it's an interesting angle, isn't it? I mean, this thing about confidence, one of the things that struck me about it, we've been doing a lot of work, and I've been doing particularly a lot of work on the difference between confidence that's presented, interpersonal confidence, how confident people seem, and the internal conversation of how confident they actually are in their own abilities. And, you know, that's the one that often catches people out. With the research we've been doing, we've identified there's often quite a disparity where the interpersonal self-confidence is high and the confidence in own abilities is often much lower. And for a leader, that's a challenge, because they're going to have a lot of long, dark nights of the soul.
Yeah, there are so many different reasons for that. So interpersonal confidence is a type of confidence, but in leadership circle, there tends to be confidence around content, for want of a better word, you know, knowing your stuff, but also confidence in how effective that knowledge is in deployment against the problems that any organization is facing. So that used to be called talking a good game, I think, right? Being able to, you know, bandy things around and hold your own seat around the table and eat the biscuits and drink the coffee and sound like you know what you're talking about. A lot of people can do that. But when it comes to relying on something, which is what confidence actually is, you know, the ability to rely on someone or something, then we have to look there and see what is trying to be relied upon. And if the thing is themselves doing something to get an outcome for the company, if they don't think they can actually do it, then we've got a bit of a problem. And that's usually to do with too much emphasis on capabilities that may be dating or rusty or wrong for the job versus the abundance of strength they might have if they're in the right job. And it was actually pretty easy for them to draw upon it. And they know that whatever comes up in the company's remit, they're going to be able to make a decent go at it because they feel sure in their own ability.
Given the speed of change in the last few years and probably the predicted speed of change over the next few, if you're reliant on experience, you're in trouble a lot of the time, aren't you? Because it becomes irrelevant so fast with everything in flux. So people need I think if they're operating in a challenging times, they mostly are, a whole range of things that they can rely upon rather than the two trump cards they've had in the past, maybe.
Yeah, I think historically, and maybe still currently, there was this idea of being able to hang your hat on something you've been rather good at for a while. If that thing has been based on a learned capability and no one wants that anymore, and it's got nothing to do with your inherent strength, then it's going to be difficult to learn at the pace that is required to develop another capability, let's say, you're always going to be 1 foot behind the other trying to get up to speed with the pace of change. Whereas if you're applying innate strength to the exam question and it's evolving all the time, you can rely on yourself to understand it and contribute something and refine it as you go. So that's a different kind of confidence to which, you know, than which most people have been trying to get, I suppose, over the years. It's been more the hanging out on something and dining out on it for, you know, a long time.
It's interesting, isn't it? When I left education, people said, well, what will you do now? Because that's what you do. You know, you teach and you run a school. And so what if you're not going to go back to a school, what will you do? And we can learn knowledge so quickly and easily, and it's at our fingertips every second of the day. But actually the skills and the values and the behaviours that we bring can be applied anywhere with anybody. And I guess back to your confidence piece, having the confidence to know that it's okay that you don't know yet, but you know who does. And actually as a coach, that you can ask really good questions to find out the information, whether it's coaching AI to help you to learn something or coaching with a colleague to find out what they know and what we can learn from them. Actually, that confidence to be a little bit vulnerable and be honest about it and feel okay about that.
Yeah.
That's an interesting place to play.
I agree with you. Taking that a bit further, I think all that we are is portable. So when we move from one thing to another, one part of a company to other, we leave and join another one or something changes, all those things that we are goes with us, including our understanding of our own strengths, our confidence, and all of the stuff you were talking about a while ago with the PQ reps and the saboteurs, that all comes along for the ride as well, doesn't it? So everything's transferable. The more we understand it, the more powerful we become, I think, in navigating these changes and demands of working life.
Yeah. I'm trying to work out at the moment whether what I know now is because I'm older and so therefore having been kicking around for nearly 50 years, it all makes a bit more sense now, or whether if I had started being exposed to this when I was much younger, I might have learned quicker. And I remember my mum saying when she got to 60, she realised that she could be honest now that she was older, and she hoped I'd learn to be honest younger than she learned. And I definitely did. And I wonder whether we can roll that clock, you know, back. So that my area of interest really is how we support young people to understand their character, their values, their motivations, their saboteurs. How they ask questions, how they interact with others. And if we'd explicitly did that when they were in their teenage years, kind of, is that too early or not?
I don't think so. I think they definitely can cope with it. And actually, in talking to my own kids and other young people, there's a whole vocabulary that wasn't around when I was younger. I'm 50 as well. I didn't have any of that language as a young person. And I don't think I was as self-aware in any way compared to some of the people I talk to now in their 20s. So I think that's definitely a really good thing, that people have that function, that facility, that ability to understand themselves in different ways in a much more, popular sense, I suppose, than we ever did. So it's much more an accepted thing to be in touch with how you feel about something, to voice those feelings, to notice things about yourself. I just don't think that awareness existed so much before.
I wonder if at an identity level it would help as well with the fact that many young people, their identity comes from whether they look like someone who's on Instagram or who's famous or, right. You know, so it's much more about how we look rather than who we are inside. And so maybe a shift from the exterior to the interior, and that language that goes with it and that self-awareness may kind of potentially positively support some of the areas that we're having difficulties with for young people, where they're under so much pressure to compare and lose, you know, the pleasure of life through the thief of joy, which is comparison.
It's interesting, going back to something that you've both said already, that I realized I was lucky. I got diagnosed with what was allegedly a terminal illness when I was 41, which is not usually what people think of as lucky, but it meant the whole thing stopped. All of that accumulation of titles and wealth and success and all this trappings all stopped because I was told I had a matter of months. So I did a kind of a recalibrate, and everything went, and I kind of. I remember spending an whole weekend with Helen. We went spent a weekend with two flip charts and wrote down on one flip chart what I could do and on the other flip chart what I liked. And then we did a bit of a cross-reference and went, well, quite like that one and that one and that one, and I can do those things. And I went off to spend a few weeks as a teacher in a college, and changed the whole direction of my life. And I realized that all the things I'd accumulated were actually compensations for the rest of it that sucked.
So,
Yeah, that resonates. I had a
yeah.
lovely car when I was ahead, and I didn't really get
Yeah.
much of a chance to drive it because I was always blooming well at work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe your little Z4, it was lovely.
Yeah,
I
and
thought
it
it was
felt great.
great.
That was the compensation for having an important job in inverted commas.
Yeah.
But I rarely got to properly drive it because I was too busy.
Those were the things when I had a Z4 as well. Thought I was the dog's danglies driving that.
All you children with your Z4s. I had a Jaguar 3.6 coupe in Holborn. That was my compensation, and it looked beautiful through the window. About the only time I ever saw it was out through the window because I was working 100 hours a week.
If I could interrupt this episode of Top Gear, I just putting it in a slightly different direction. I was wondering, Andrew, in your work, if there are areas or topics or issues which are rooted in confidence, but that it wouldn't appear that that would be the case. You know, that people are then surprised when they realize that that's what the issues are.
I think one of them that seems to come up again and again is when someone is contemplating doing something different. They haven't usually discussed it in the way that they could have done with the people that matter to them. So, people at home, for example, because they aren't sure that it'll be okay if they have those conversations and actually say the thing that they need to say. To give themselves permission internally to go and make those changes. So they hold back because they're not confident or sure of their own narrative around it, their own reasons for it. So that seems to be confidence hidden in plain sight that needs to be resolved before those conversations can actually happen. And then the thing can get unblocked, the conversation said, the agreements made, and the action taken.
Yeah, that's why I think your comment about making different agreements with yourself is so significant in this journey. I was very fortunate that I had a rock solid relationship and that we had all those conversations together, because it would never have occurred to me to do it any other way. But for
Yeah.
people who aren't in that position, it's so much harder to have that kind of self-awareness and self-curiosity to be able to make those changes.
Yeah, I think that's right. If you're fortunate enough to have somebody who is confident in you, then it helps you be confident in yourself for the right reasons.
Because I can imagine being afraid to let the people you care about down would be one of the biggest handbrakes for anybody.
Certainly, and there are all kinds of circumstances that can come up in, from perceived loss of lifestyle for one, versus some cultural things that exist in certain parts of the world where status is very important, and if you make a decision that changes that, then you affect the whole family, and all kinds of other questions come up. So yeah, there are many different guises that this can raise itself, but they all come down to agreements in the end.
Yeah, because it raises the whole idea of shame, doesn't it? That whole thing about
Yeah.
feeling ashamed that you've, because nobody's ever allowed to go down.
No.
Always the next step up, the next step up, the next step up. And that, yeah, I went through a lot of that. And Sean Aker at Harvard talks about this in his Happiness Advantages study, that for so many people, we've pushed happiness over the horizon. You have it when we do this next thing, or and then the thing after that. And then the one after that, but you never actually get there. Yeah, I'm a big fan of the idea of micro joys.
Yeah.
That idea that you can pick up these little moments of wonder in your day, which could be on looking out the window and seeing a bird.
I'm reading a book at the moment which is about the elimination of hurry. And it's by an American pastor, and he was running a huge church and chose to take a step down to run one smaller church in the group based in America. And he talked about the fact that joy was being lost because he was persistently in a hurry. Mm. And it took me back to when I did my NLP training and we did some timeline work. And when I stood on the timeline and talked about where now was and where the future and the past were, I realized that now was literally a millimeter on the timeline because I was far too busy looking forwards or backwards.
Yeah.
And so I think I've probably spent the last 5-7 years trying to extend the moment to make it bigger, to appreciate the joy and the happiness, because otherwise I noticed that my happiness was so fleeting. It literally was a, you know, the click of the fingers, and I was appreciating it and what's next. And so again, my saboteurs create the hurry, the restlessness, the what next.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the challenges for leaders, bringing it back to our core topic, you know, for leaders. So much of their job has been made to be about achievement, you know, goals, targets, milestones, whatever it might be. That the ability to be happy on the journey has been kind of removed, edited out.
Yeah.
And we need, in a purpose-driven society, we need to bring it back, because otherwise, what the hell is it all for?
Yeah, it feels like it's back to what value are we trying to create and for whom? And along the way, you know, we had a meeting yesterday which involved lots of laughter. And at the end of the day, that was the thing that stuck out for me about the highlight of my day. And we did all sorts of other things during the day. But the moments of connection with people and the moments of feeling the light amongst the work. And on top of that, then how else does an organization create value for its customers other than selling them a product? What else is it? Why? Because at the end of the day, you know, so many things don't really exist. Money doesn't really exist. And all the things that are in the world, we don't really need. So what sometimes I think, what is the point of all of this? And where will we get to be where we're at a position where we think, that was all worthwhile. I added value in some way that feels meaningful rather than very transactional.
I do wonder how many leaders tie in their personal satisfaction to the organizational satisfaction and make that what it's all about. And obviously once they start doing that, they lose sight of what they themselves want to do. Is that something that you see, Andrew, in your work, that people, that leaders tie that in their own happiness into the organization's success?
Yes. I mean, that does happen, especially when it comes to big change projects or large, you know, things that involve moving a lot of money around. People do align themselves to those outcomes. The meaning of it seems to get lost quite quickly, though, once the number's been hit, you know, once a successful year has been had and the growth has been achieved. It doesn't tend to stay in the same way that you would notice if a leader had contributed to the development of a bunch of people, or hired the right talent, or made a critical decision that resulted in standing up a new division and in employing a ton more people, but made a difference to the local community. So yes, it on the face of it, these financial goals, or, you know, even the production of, you know, a wonderful new piece of technology or the creation of a new service, it's really only seems to hit home for people when they associate it to the meaning it would have for people who'd be impacted by it, rather than the thing itself, the money itself, you know, the widget that's been created. So all the time I'm coaching people who are looking for more meaning in their work. So especially those that are really close to money, I find. Those people who are in financial services or everything that makes that happen, you know, unless they really, really, really love money, they're all trying to find ways of using the skills in that place to go and have more of an impact. So there's a huge movement towards people being interested in renewables or corporate social responsibility or third sector or, you know, child poverty or, you know, various charitable causes, just to get some meaning into their day. Yeah. So helped quite a lot of people transfer skills they've got into a sector that meant more for them.
For me, anyway, I had to get to a point where I felt like I'd earned the right to do something that seemed selfish. Yeah, that I'd paid enough into the credit column to feel like it was okay for me to take a different path now. And I had to, that was an internal conversation. I had to get to that point. And I wasn't there some of the time. It's one of the things that derailed my music career was that I didn't feel like I deserved it yet. And then by the time I did feel like I deserved it, I was too old.
That's still time, Nigel.
Yes, it's true.
I've seen
headline billing at our wedding, so it's his first headline gig this year.
I've seen the man play, and it's amazing.
Well, that's gonna break the internet with people looking for tickets for that. with your experience, what do you with your coaching experience, what would you consider to be the sort of the most important skills that leaders should be working on?
I would always say self-awareness.
Okay.
Self-awareness to start with. Awareness of what's going on inside your mind, awareness of the impact of your words on other people. So much could be solved for if leaders had to think about how they're showing up, the story they're telling themselves, the agreements they're making with themselves, and what they actually want the other person to think, to do, to be. But it's in short supply, that level of thinking about interactions. Self-awareness, if all leaders had 1% more, we would be in a very different place right now.
Yes. Well, Tasha Eric in America, she's done a load of work on this. She talks about self-awareness unicorns. They did surveyed thousands of leaders, and 80-odd% of them felt they were extremely self-aware. When they performed tests and observations on them, it was about 6% that actually knew themselves particularly well. And there's almost a kind of an inevitability about this because we keep promoting people on the sizzle and not thinking too much about the sausage.
What a turn of phrase that is.
Love that expression.
Yeah, no.
Sizzle and not the sausage.
Wow. That's, I mean, with self-awareness, if self-esteem is low, and leaders, there are leaders out there with low self-esteem, they actually sometimes think they're not worth knowing that well and don't want to do the work to be more self-aware. So getting on your own side in a coaching environment is a very important step to take. And I always start there of, you know, making sure people really embrace their strengths, understand what limiting beliefs they're holding about those strengths, accept and have a good laugh at where they don't find things easy, and just be really, really grateful that other people are good at that stuff. Mm-hmm. It's a huge relief if you can just get on with doing you, and realizing that you're worth knowing. So I spend quite a lot of people helping them to understand that they are indeed worth knowing. And then they can get on with the job of increasing their self-awareness about that. So
the other thing I wanted to ask you, Andrew, was, again, with everything that you've learned from your recent work, looking back on the leader you were, how would you have changed your leadership style?
That's a great question, isn't it? I suppose I would have found different ways to deliver bad news. I got better at it towards the end, but certainly in the early days, I would shy away from sharing difficult discussions, especially as it relates to underperformance, let's say, because, you know, the consequence for somebody who isn't performing in their role, if they can't retrieve that, may be that they get moved on from the role or redeployed elsewhere. And that's not a nice conversation to have. Later, I realized that those kinds of conversations are actually beneficial for everybody because they shorten the duration of the poor performance for the company, but they also shorten the path to being happier for the person who is not performing well. So getting better at that, I think, would have been really valuable. And developing more the idea of, you know, as a leader and, you know, with a team, I'm okay, you're okay, we're okay, but we're talking about this now, and it's got nothing to do with you as a person. It's to do with what we're working on, how able you are to be effective in that. And having that charter there always at the forefront. And I got much better at it as I became more seasoned, but I wish I'd learned it earlier.
Andrew, thank you for sharing your wisdom and your insights with us today. I know it's been really interesting for me, and I'm sure it's been interesting for everyone listening. If any of our listeners want to find out more about you, where's the best place to go?
Sure. LinkedIn probably is the best place to go. So if you type in Andrew Richards coach, you will find me there. I'm happy to connect there with anybody who wants to.
Brilliant. I'll put a link in the show notes as well so that people can
okay,
find you direct.
Great.
But again, brilliant. Thanks. And thanks a lot. And thank you, Rona. Thank you, Nigel. Thank you for being such wonderful chums.
I love it.
And we look forward to seeing you next time. If you're interested in developing your coaching approach as a leader, we're hosting a free coaching masterclass focused on using coaching language to create stronger, more effective conversations with your team. It's designed to be practical and relevant, and you'll leave with actionable insights to implement straight away. And did I mention it's free? It's on March the 19th. You can find out more and register at beinspirational.com/events. I'll put a link in the show notes, and I hope you can join us. Otherwise, we'd love to hear your thoughts on the topics and issues discussed today. You can find us on LinkedIn by searching Be Inspirational or email us at info@beinspirational.com. If you want to find out more about Inspirational Group and the work we do towards leadership for a better tomorrow, you can visit our website at beinspirational.com. We'll see you next time.